be careful what you think and say about this face in front of you. Now, I know it's not Jamie's. Have you heard from Jamie at all? Anybody last, let's see, this is third Sunday away, is that right? You know what happens to a pastor? He needs to take at least 2 weeks of vacation. I've worked with pastors all over the state of Ohio and Kentucky. I'm what they call a district superintendent. I have 65 ministries that are a part of my oversight. So I spend a lot of time on the road, a lot of time with people like Jamie. And I found that when pastors go on vacation, if they don't take 2 weeks, they really don't get much time away. The first 3 days that they're away, they're trying to disconnect. They've got all these things going on in their brain, and their brain is starting to collapse and slow down a little bit to accept the reality that they don't have the same pace they have to keep up. The problem, though, comes on the other end of the vacation. You probably do this, too, don't you? You start to think about what you got to do at work when you get back. You know, the pile builds up, the calls will be there, the list is going to be longer. There's got to be some folks that are out of joint that you have to put back in shape again. You know what I'm saying? Well, Jamie is already starting to reconnect. I want you to know that. He called me on my way down here yesterday morning. I had an appointment in Lexington before I drove over from the service last night. In the typical Jamie fashion, I expected him to say, I'm on two wheels now and I'll meet you there. He didn't say that. What he said was, are you going? Are you on your way? He wanted to be sure. You know what? I wanted to say, I'm not going. What are you talking about? I wanted to give him a real panic attack. But I want you to know that I'm glad to be with you here today. And it is just great to see everyone. I met James Brown. I want you to know this is a first for me. And I thought, that's great. And he has a head just like mine. Congratulations, James. Turn with me to Isaiah chapter 6. What I want to say to you is entitled, Getting Out of the Mess. From Isaiah chapter 6, listen to what was happening in the life of Isaiah. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord seated on a throne, high and exalted. By the way, have you heard this passage before? I saw the Lord seated on a throne, high and exalted, and the train of his robe filled the temple. Above him were seraphs, each with 6 wings. With 2 wings they covered their faces, with 2 they covered their feet, and with 2 they were flying. But they were calling to one another, Holy, holy, holy is the Lord Almighty. The whole earth is full of his glory. At the sound of their voices, the doorposts and thresholds shook, and the temple was filled with smoke. Woe to me, I cried. I'm ruined, for I'm a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips, and my eyes have seen the King, the Lord Almighty. Then one of the seraphs flew to me with a live coal in his hand, which he had taken with tongs from the altar. With it he touched my mouth and said, See, this has touched your lips, and your guilt is taken away, and your sin atoned for. Then I heard the voice of the Lord saying, Whom shall I send? And who will go for us? And I said, Here am I. Send me. He said, Go and tell this people. Have you heard the name Tony Evans? Tony Evans is an African-American pastor preaching in Dallas, Texas. He's a radio teacher, written a number of books, used to speak at a lot of the men's conferences. Tony Evans opened his sermon to his congregation in Dallas with psychology that is very different from our culture today. Our culture really believes, I'm okay, you're okay, let's just learn to get along, right? What you do is fine as long as I don't bug you, and what I do is fine as long as you don't bug me. We don't have to debug each other, right, James? Let's leave each other alone. I'm okay, you're okay. But contrary to that, began his message like this, radically different, I think, to shake up the crowd. He said this, "I'm a mess, and you're a mess." And then he began to apply that a little bit more. He said, now think about that with me. If I'm a mess and you're a mess, then our marriages are a mess. If our marriages are a mess, then our families that we're living in are a mess too. If our families are a mess, then our communities and towns and cities are a mess, right? If our cities, towns, and communities are a mess, then our states are a mess. If our states are a mess, then what's a mess too? The country's a mess, right? If the country's a mess, then what's the next thing? The world's a mess, right? If the world's a mess, then the universe is a mess. And if the universe is a mess, then the, well, who knows? But it's a mess. The nation of Israel is a mess in Isaiah's time. You can read all about it in the chapter just before Isaiah chapter 6. There's grasping, materialism, and unrestrained covetousness. Does that sound anything like our day? There was a profit motive. There were people saying, I'm going to take as much advantage of you as I possibly can. I'm going to get as much out of you as I possibly can. Why were the financial regulation reforms passed? The reason given was to what? Cut down on the corruption and greed of what? Wall Street. I'm not here to debate that with you. I'm simply saying, we're living in an age of unrestrained covetousness. There was a party atmosphere. There was pleasure-seeking people. They loved their alcohol. That was their drug of choice. And they drank alcohol for breakfast, and they drank it for lunch, and they drank it for their evening meal. And they lived in a fuzz all day long. There was moral corruption. Good was called evil. Evil was called good. And they didn't have any way of defining the difference between the two. In fact, there is this graphic detail given to us in Isaiah chapter 5. People would shamelessly take their sin. They would cart it for sale into the open marketplace, and they would be proud of their acts of disobedience and corruption. Can you imagine? Most of us try to hide our sin, don't we? We don't want others to see the secrets that are going on in our life. But in this nation's case, they flaunted it. They were proud of it. They displayed it for others to look at. There was corrupt leadership. Oh, is that a mess or what? And not only was the situation a mess, but they were a mess in the mess, weren't they? So how do you walk out of that? How do you get out of that mess? I'm going to give you four exclamation points from Isaiah chapter 6 and Isaiah's experience that will help you walk out of any mess you're in or you are. Are you with me? Now, do you know what an exclamation point is? It's different from a period. It's different from a question mark. A question mark says, I'm not sure about this. Let's talk about it. The period says, this is an indicative statement, right? Accept it for what it is. What does an exclamation point do at the end of a statement? What does it say? It says, important, urgent, take note of this, underline it, don't miss it. And there's four things in Isaiah's response to this mess that he is and this mess he's in that we can't miss. We've got to take with us. We must underline to figure out how to get out of the mess. Here's the first one. The first exclamation is simply this. Whew. Now, say that with me. Whew. If you want to act it out with me, that's fine too. this sense of relaxation, don't panic, come from? Where does Isaiah in this experience say, "Phew"? Well, he says it in the year that King Uzziah died. That doesn't make sense. Think about it. There's a mess. And the mess in the nation got worse. The bad got worse. Because here's a king that the nation had depended upon for 52 years. He had been there, stabilizing their international alliances, increasing their economic condition, being sure that in the middle of their mess, they had the freedom to be corrupt. But it was there. And people could say, "Don't worry about what's happening in our nation. Uzziah will take care of us." Do you hear that? The king's there. He's always on the throne. But now the nation lost the one they had depended upon. Ever lost someone you loved and counted on to be there? And they're gone? Ever experienced that? It's in the middle of that that Isaiah says, "I saw the Lord." Now, I want to check you on a spelling test this morning. Would someone here spell Lord for me? L what? O? L-O-R-D, right? Now, I want you to look at something. Look at verse 1 and see how Lord is spelled. How is it spelled there? L what? R-D, right? Show us verse 3. How is Lord spelled? L-O. Boy, we're a bright group, aren't we? Did you notice any difference about the way those two spellings were printed? Did you notice any difference about them? Look at this one. Capital L, and then you notice the smaller letters, O-R-D, but what are they, upper or lower case? What? Upper case. Go back to verse 1. L, what? O-R-D, spelled the same. Well, what about the O-R-D, upper or lower case? What is it? They make a mistake in the printing in the English Bible? No. In verse 3, the uppercase, the L and then uppercase O-R-D, means the name for God, Yahweh, Jehovah. Barack Obama, the name for God. Look back at verse 1. When Isaiah said, "I saw the Lord," it's L and then it's what? Lowercase, right? O-R-D. It does not stand for the name for God. But the original Hebrew word used there is Adonai. It's a title for God. President. You hear the title? Barack Obama. He is what? He holds the office of what? President. Isaiah says, in the middle of this mess, it got messier. The king vanishes off the scene. And when the sovereign, the king, went off the scene and we thought we were leaderless, I saw the real sovereign behind it all. The Lord. The Adonai. The one who is really in control. And guess what Isaiah says? He has always been there all the time, no matter what. Is that good news? And Isaiah goes, "Don't panic. Don't get uptight. Do you hear that? Don't worry. Don't rush to judgment. Relax. The one that's really in charge hasn't left anyway. He's still there." Twyla Parrish has written a fascinating song called "God's in Control." Listen to what she writes. "This is no time for fear. This is a time for faith and determination. Don't lose the vision here. Carried away by the motion and emotion here. Hold on to all that you hide in your heart. There's one thing that has always been true. It holds the world together. God is in control. Say that with me. God is in control. She goes on to write this. History marches on. There's a bottom line drawn across the ages. Culture can make its plan, but the line never changes. No matter how the deceptions may fly, there's one thing that's always been true. It will be true forever. What is that? God is what? In control. So we can what? Do you know what we do when we get into a mess? Don't we panic? Don't we get uptight? Don't we worry? The first thing is to realize God hasn't left me. He's still in control. He's still in charge. He's still around. Before I show you what the next exclamation point is, I want you to underline and remember. Let me tell you a story that will help illustrate the experience that Isaiah is about to have. Have you heard the name Pele? We just finished World Cup soccer. A few years ago, Pele was the greatest soccer player that ever lived. My son. At the time that we were on a one-month vacation from serving an international church in Kinshasa, Zaire, he found a tape as a third grader of Pele. He loved soccer. He found this tape, but we didn't have time to view it before we traveled back from New York to Africa. He put that tape into his backpack. When we got home into Kinshasa, first thing he did was he took that tape out of his backpack, put it in the playback machine, and this is what I heard in the other room. Wow. 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 And then I heard this, wow! Sounds like James Brown, doesn't it? He came running into where I was. He said, Dad, you've got to come and see this. I ran into the room where he was. He rewound the tape. And I watched Pele go down the middle of the field with his sock. I mean, he is going full tilt, but the ball is no more than 3 inches from his feet. Always in control. And I go, wow. And then he hits this ball with his left foot. I'm right-footed, and I have a hard time hitting the ball. He hits it with his left foot. It travels at a speed along the ground that looked like it was going, I don't know, 30 miles an hour. And it hits this right wing player who's running down the right wing as fast as he can, right on his feet. And I go, wow. And this right winger takes it into the corner, and then he elevates this ball. And it looks like it's going to go out the other side of the field. And Pele dashes down the center of this field. His back is now to the goal. He flips himself into the air, and he catches the ball on his back foot, and he jams it into the net. And I'm going, wow! That's what Isaiah is experiencing now. Wow! As he sees God high and exalted on this throne. And the robe of this God filled the entire temple. I've been to a wedding where I've seen the robe of a wedding gown fill two or three stairs, haven't you? Ever seen a robe that filled the entire temple? And Isaiah goes, wow. And flying like celestial helicopters over the throne are these seraphs, and they're singing one to another, holy, 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 holy is the Lord God Almighty. The whole earth is full of His glory. Holy. When you and I think of that word, we often think that what the Bible's saying is pure, 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 moral, 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 right, right, right,
There's nobody like him, nobody better than him. He's got it all together all of the time. He's the best that there ever was. Think of our God's knowledge. He makes the Library of Congress seem like a matchbox when compared to him. Think of our God's understanding of the law of physics and of all the sciences. He makes Stephen Hawking, who we believe to be the most brilliant of all physicists, seem like a kindergarten student. Think of his providence. There's not a single hair that falls or a sparrow that he doesn't know about. Think of his faithfulness. Every promise he ever made, he's kept. Think of his purity. There has never been a millisecond of a bad motive or bad attitude in him. Wow! Think of his patience, his long-suffering, his grace. He is not willing that any should perish. Why has Jesus not come back? Peter tells us because God's long-suffering and patient. And he wants to give everybody a chance to hear the good news of what Christ has done. Amen. Wow. This sovereign about whom we can say, whew, is superior in every way. And if we're going to dig ourselves out of the mess, then we have to believe he's smarter than we are, better than we are, knows the beginning from the end, right? So that we can relax and trust in him. Exclamation. The scene shifts. Isaiah has been experiencing what we would describe as exultation and joy and praise and worship. Now suddenly the doorposts begin to shake and the thresholds begin to shake. Now can you imagine a stable building limbering up like our body? And it begins to shake, rattle, and roll where he is. Can you imagine? And all of a sudden, this building that he thought was solid and stable and concrete and that could never fail begins to do all this he's never seen before in his whole life. And he says, whoa, I'm ruined because I'm a man of unclean lips and I live among a people of unclean lips. I'm no better than them and they're no better than me. You see, Isaiah was the most brilliant orator and writer in all the Old Testament. My guess, if he took his peers out, they'd say, he's the one we want to write the speeches for our king. He's the one that we want to do all the promotional vehicles for our party. And Isaiah was a master at words and at graphics. And what does he say? Even the best that I have is no better than the worst that others have. I realized this when I was at a conference, a seminar. Three rows sitting down from me was a lady. I was trying to listen to the speaker. I'm sure she was trying to listen to the speaker too, but she was listening to the speaker in an irritating way. She had this pen she was clicking. Have you ever been near somebody that just clicked the pen over and over and over and over and over again? And she didn't quit. I mean, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes. I got to tell you, when I hit about the 15-minute mark, I'm saying, you know, I'm going to come down there, rip that stupid pen out of your hand, throw it on the floor, and stomp on it. as soon as I said those words, pointing out her deficiencies, this is absolutely true, I looked over in my hand. I had taken out my pen, and I was clicking it. I could bring you up here, compare my life to yours in terms of kindness or faithfulness or compassion. I'd probably do okay since I'm a pastor and you're not. Well, you look deeply into my heart. I'm going to tell you something. There's not a person in this room any better than anybody else. Is that right? What do we do with that sin? Especially as we say before a God who's got it all together, who's sovereign and who is superior in every possible way. When I compare my faithfulness to yours, man, it's nowhere near it. When I compare my purity to yours, it's nowhere near it. When I compare, I'm done. Whoa. It's over. Let me tell you some good news this morning. There's a story that's told by an archbishop when he was speaking about three boys who had done in one night everything the imagination could conceive and everything the wallet could support. Everything that was ugly, everything that was vile, everything that was evil, they had done it that night. Late into that night, they walked past a church and realized it was still open. And two of the boys turned to the third and said, "We dare you to go in there, go into the confessional booth, and tell every ugly detail of everything we did tonight to that priest. If you do, we'll give you all the money we've got left in our pocket." Now, guys, you and I both know when we're given a dare, we got to take it, don't we? Even though it's a pretty dumb one to take. And this young man took it. He went into that confessional booth. The other fellas moved into the back rows of that cathedral. And those boys were listening as that one young man confessed to that priest every ugly, morbid detail, and was going into it in such graphic definition that the boys themselves were getting uneasy with everything that had been done. The priest now realized that there was something going on. And so the priest says to that young man in the booth next to him, confessing as Isaiah confessed, "I'm a man of unclean lips," but not sincerely, right? Just for a joke. And that priest said to him, "Son, you can be absolved immediately. This is all I want you to do. I want you to go out into this cathedral. I want you to go down to the altar. I want you to kneel at that altar. I want you to look up into the face of Jesus, who died for you, who gave his life for you. And I want you to look into the face of the one who loves you that much and say to him, 'I don't care a flip about you.' If you'll do that, son, you can be absolved immediately." That young man, because he realized he had to take the whole thing, that was the dare, you had to do anything the priest told you. So that young man walked into the cathedral, went down the center aisle, knelt at the altar, looked up into the one who had taken his place on the cross, who was ready to forgive his sins, who was saying to him, "Just as you are, without one plea, I'm ready to give you forgiveness if you'll simply say, 'I've got a need.'" And that young man said, "I knelt there, I looked into the face of Jesus, and said, 'Jesus, I know how much you've cared for me. I know how much you love me. And I'm a terrible sinner. Would you please forgive me?'"
archbishop had finished telling that story, he turned to the audience, and this is what he said. Folks, I know that to be true because I was that young man that found forgiveness that night in Jesus Christ. Whoa. And the whoa becomes a wow, doesn't it? Because the sovereign who is superior to us is also the one who saves, who forgives, who cleanses, who says, you can start all over again by my grace. Is that good news or what? You see, we're not just in a mess. We are a mess, right? And isn't it good whether we are or we're in it, we can say, I've got someone who's walking with me, who's got it all together, who's in control. I've got someone who's walking with me today who's superior than I am, smarter than me, brighter than me, purer than me, more faithful than me, who understands it all. And I've got someone who loves me absolutely unconditionally and says, you're forgiven when I simply what? Confess and acknowledge my sin. Now I said there's four, didn't I? Have you got the three? What's the first one? What's the second one? What's the third one? Whoa. Here's the last one. And this is about all I have to do with what God has done for me when He wants to walk with me. Because now my job description becomes very simple, doesn't it? Here's the exclamation. What? 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 The sovereign, superior, saving God says, whom shall we stand and who will go for us? And Isaiah jumps to his feet in confidence and says, I'm your man. I'm not quite sure that's how it happened. You know what I mean? Here am I, said me. I think in humility and with a deep sense of what can I do after all you've done for me in gratitude and in trust and the responsiveness of love to Him who's done all that for Him, Isaiah says, with open arms, here I am. What do you want me to do? And to Isaiah, he says, I want you to go and tell. Go and tell this message. Go and tell this people they're in a mess. They're not going to listen to you, but tell them anyway. Tell them I care for them. Tell them I want them to come back. Tell them I love them. Go and tell them. I started to think about that last night. I thought that's not the only go God says to us. In Matthew 5 and verse 22, He says, go and be reconciled. In other words, if you've got a conflict with people, the what is, how can I help reconcile to someone I'm in conflict with? Do you hear that? And I thought of Luke chapter 10 and verse 37, where He said to the expert of the law who said, who is my neighbor? And Jesus said, go and do likewise. Do what the Good Samaritan did. Find someone in need and love them just where they are. Isn't that great? Let me tell you something. If in the middle of the mess I'm in the middle of the mess I am, if I can get my relationships together and be what He wants me to be, if I can do what He wants me to do in the right way, right? By responding to those in need around me, if I can say what He wants me to say in spite of the peer pressure to not say it, if I can get my saying right by being right and my doing right, that's pretty good, isn't it? Because no longer would I be a mess. Instead, I would be moving
action that would be helping my nation, my community, my family out of that mess by simply saying, what do you want me to be and do and say? I'll simply surrender to you. Wow. You're a mess. I'm a mess, you're a mess. Your relationship's a little bit of a mess. How can I walk out of it? What's the first one? I've got someone walking with me who's not going to leave me. He's going to always be there. He knows the beginning from the end and everything in the middle. Wow. He knows who I am and knows what I need and knows the situation, right? He's got the wisdom and insight and righteousness. Do I wonder if he loves me? He's forgiven me. I don't have to worry about my past anymore. Do you realize that? He wants to communicate with me. And all I've got to say is what? In the middle of it, as bad as it seems to be, as worse as it seems to get, sovereign, superior, saving Lord, what do you want? I surrender.